makes the Jewish world go round. So thank God. It's really, it's a great thing to see. But I thank Rabbi Van, and really he's, he and his family, unbelievable people to keep it going here, and all of you for inviting me here this evening to speak to you. It's been a few years since I was last here, and it's always a pleasure to once again reawaken what is always consistent. The I want to begin, now I'll tell you, you know, just between you and me, well, no, not between you and me, let's just put it out there. I mean, there's no secrets here, all 20 of us here in the room. Rabbi Van is really, I'm a little worried as well in the fact that he is not behaving very Jewish-like. And he's trying to keep the time that we should start a 7:45. This is not normal. This is abnormal behavior. This is not behavior that is conducive of a rabbi. And one should check Rabbi Van's lineage to make sure that indeed he is from Jewish descent. But he did tell me that because of that, he wanted me to start a 7:45, but he said people will straggle in a little later. So start with something and whet the appetite. And then we'll move on to the real lecture at hand. So I'm going to start with the whetting the appetite, and then we'll get to the lecture, which is all the boring part. That was a joke. Doesn't matter. There's a very interesting observation. You know, we're now in the middle of Sefer Shemot, in the middle of the exodus of the Jewish people from Egypt. And we know that this week's parsha, this week's Torah portion, B'Shalach, B'nei Yisrael, the Jewish people, they come out of Egypt, they have the parting of the Reed Sea, and so on and so forth. And we all know the story. But if we reflect for a moment back 2-3 weeks ago, the first time that Moshe and Aaron are in charge by God to go and to tell the Jewish people that they're coming out of Egypt. And they do. They go to the Jewish people, they relay that exact message. And the Torah says that the Jewish people, Vayeamen ha'am vayikdu vayishtachavu. Vayeamen comes from the Hebrew word emunah. They have faith in Moshe and Aaron. They subscribe to his plan. We're with you 100%. Let's go for it. And not only do they say that, excuse me, but they demonstrate it through their actions. Vayikdu vayishtachavu. They prostrate in front of Moshe and Aaron. They bow down to Moshe and Aaron. Obviously, it seems in awe of God and the promise that he makes. So they are 100% sold on the program. But yet, a week later, in Parshat Va'era, that we read 2 weeks ago, the Torah says, all of the, what we call, Arba Lishonot Geula, the languages, the verses that are used to describe the redemption of the Jewish people. And we describe them at the Seder Pesach. Seder Passover, we sit there and it says, Vehotzeiti, Vehitzalti, Vegaalti, Velakachti, Veheveti. The 4 cups of wine, 5. Fifth one is the Koshel Eliyahu, Elijah's cup. And those 4 or 5 cups correspond to the 5 types of vernaculars of languages which are used by God describing the Jewish people coming out of Egypt. And God says very clearly, beautiful, I'm going to take you out from the pangs of Egypt. I'm going to redeem you and save you from the work. I'm going to redeem you with an outstretched hand. I will then take you for me as a nation. And then I will bring you to none other than the land. I'll bring you to Eretz Yisrael, to the promised land of the Jewish people. And here, right after these promises, Moshe, it says, Vayidaber Moshe Kena B'nei Yisrael, Moses says the exact, you know, verbatim that God tells him to say. V'lo shamu el Moshe mikotzer ruach u'me'avodah kasha. But here, they absolutely are not willing to listen to him. From the, apparently, what it seems to be, mikotzer ruach, the hard work, the difficult work, the duties that are at hand. What happened? Why the first time they're willing to listen to him? The second time, they just have no patience for him whatsoever. We're fed up. We're busy. Stop, preaching to us. Get a life. What's going on? So there's a fascinating insight that I heard from Rav Moshe, Rav Moti Greenberg, who's the Rosh Hashiva of Kerem Biavne. He says like this: the first time that Moses and Aaron describe the Jewish people to the Jewish people God's proposed plan, it's very simple. You guys are working hard. It's very difficult. You're being persecuted. You're feeling the lash on your backs of the Egyptians. I'm going to take you out from the pain of Egypt. The Jewish people say, okay, sounds great. I mean, you know, who would argue with such a plan? But the second time, God says, let me explain to you what's going to happen. I'm going to take you out from the pangs of Egypt. Then I'm going to lead you through the desert. In the desert, you're going to learn to love this thing called the Torah. You're going to have to follow it. You're going to accept it. You're going to believe in me, that I'm your God. And then I'm going to embrace you as a nation. And then I'm going to take you into the land of Israel, which is going to be yours. Now the Jewish people say, hold on a second. The first time you told us, you're just taking us out of Egypt. From the person, you know, I don't really want to go to Israel. I'd like to go to Hawaii. I'd like a visa to go to the United States, make a couple of bucks. You know, I'm not so into the Israel thing. And, you know, I'd like to explore other religions. I don't know if I'm completely sold on you, God. You know, deliver us. Take us out of... That we're with you, 100%. And, you know, we're bowing down. We're with the program. But now you're talking to us about ideology, about loving you, about accepting the Torah, the Bible, about going to... not for me. I'll pass. And it's an amazing thing. The moment that God introduces and explains to the Jewish people that we're not talking about freedom, we're talking about freedom for the sake of an ideological existence, all of a sudden the Jewish people are at pause. That is difficult. That I don't know if I want. And this becomes very frustrating. So the point is that it's easy for us to understand and embrace freedom, to want the freedom, but what the Jewish people have to understand is that we are not free as such. We are free in a sense that we're free to be able to serve as God. We're free to be able to subscribe to God's plan, to subservient ourselves to God's plan. But otherwise, there's no point in freedom. And that already the Jewish people were frightened from. And really what's predicated here is the concept that in Judaism we don't believe in just being free and frolicking and gallivanting around without purpose. We believe in the ability to be free for the sake of a greater existence, a raison d'etre, a greater purpose for our existence. And that's what's proposed, that's what's being proposed in this book of Exodus. Exodus is for the sake of arriving at a better place, for the sake of arriving at a better existence with ideology, with the sounds of purpose and foundations, values, morals, ethics within our very purpose, our own existence as human beings. And that's really what I want to talk to you about tonight, because to be quite honest with you, I don't like saying that, because, you know, when I say to be quite honest with you, that implies that until now I've not been honest with you. I'm going to be honest with you the entire time. I have been honest with you till now. I will continue to be honest with you. But to tell you, the Islamic faith, certainly radical Islam, they believe in ideological existence. They believe that what they're doing is ideological. They believe very religiously, fervently, in what they propose. And perhaps it is, to a certain extent, convenient for us to ignore the fact of what's going on in the world around us, particularly in the United States. This past Sunday night, right? I see this young lady over here. I remember you from last time, correct? We had long talks. I remember that she was a big fan of Dennis Prager, right? I remember speaking to you about that, right?
Yes.
Your sense of change.
Absolutely, but I want you to know that I don't agree with everything he said.
Oh, okay. Well, it's okay. I'm just using. I'm using you for my subject matter. So the this past Sunday night, Dennis Prager spoke in. I was in Phoenix, Arizona, and he spoke in Phoenix. And somebody brought me along to hear his speech, and he speaks very well. I've heard him before. But I disagree with that, like you said. I disagree with some of the things that he said. And one of the things that I disagree with him is his assessment of the United States of America. His assessment of Americans is his assessment of Jewish Americans, because he paints a rather fuzzy or peachy picture that everything is okay and that the United States is strong and it's a democracy and that the Jewish community in the United States... Don't get me wrong, I'm not one of these insane, you know, right-wing Zionists who say that all ye who live in America are going to be damned or you're going to be sucked up by the earth. You know, I'm not a wacko, okay? I live in America, I grew up in America, I love the United States of America, I think it's a great country, but I am a Zionist, and therefore, obviously, I believe that ultimately the job of every single Jew, the place of every single Jew is in Israel, and that inevitably, as religious observant Jews, we believe that that will happen. All right, that's what we pray about, the Messiah, the redemption. I've had Orthodox Jews, after I say to them, I'll end one of my lectures or speeches, I'll say, and we should all be blessed with our redemption in going to Israel. And I've had Orthodox Jews come over to me and look at me like I'm completely alien. They say, "What are you serious? I mean, you really believe that that's where we got to go?" I said, "Yeah, that's what we pray about in our Shemoneh Esrei, in our prayers every morning, three times a day. I mean, we do pray that we should go to Israel. So yes, I do believe that that's part of your belief as well, whether you understand the words that you're saying or not. So ultimately, that's where we have to end up." Well, his assessment is that everything is fine here and that everything will continue. I don't believe so. I believe actually one of the biggest worries that I have with regards to the American community, less so the American Jewish community, because Jews tend to be very up to date and aware of what's going on, although the youth are not as much. But there's a certain naivete that exists. And I believe that Americans are slowly becoming irrelevant in the world scene. I've seen the difference between, for example, American youth and European youth or Israeli youth. Israeli and European youth are generally much more mature than American youth. And the reason why is because they are living with a reality that slaps them in the face. American youth are completely removed from the world scene. They don't realize the threats of what's going on around the world. They don't realize the reality that they're dealing with. And one of those realities is the very quick, widespread influence of Islam, radical Islam, throughout the world. Europe, forget about it. Europe is finished. It's already a done deal. It's pretty much, what is it, in the next 10 years, they say the majority of the population of all of France will be Islam. And we're not talking about moderate Islamists, we're talking about radical Islamists. So that's already, Europe is being swallowed up. But it is happening in the United States. And if you watch some of these films, I usually start this lecture with a film, for example, called Obsession, or The Third Jihad, or Iranian. These are films put out by Raphael Schor. They're very, very well done. And in these films, you'll see that there's even a place in upstate New York called Islam-York, which they call it that, and they train to be radical Islamists or Islamic faith, and it's unbelievable stuff what's going on right under our faces. And to a certain extent, we're either ignoring it or choosing to not pay attention to it because it's frightening. It's very frightening, and it is absolutely the largest threat to world power today, which is rather obvious: Ahmadinejad, Iran, and so on and so forth. And it's very important for us, and this is what I want to do tonight. I'm not here to paint doomsday. That's not my thing. I'm not going to sit here and tell you, this is the statistics, this is the disaster, they're going to swallow you up, you're all... That's not my thing. But it's very important for us to confront this reality, not only for the sake of identifying in order to thwart their existence, but more so for the sake of our own preservation. And that's what I'm about. That's what I want to talk to you about tonight. I started off with that Dvar Torah, with those words of Torah, because I want to demonstrate to you tonight the concept of who we are as opposed to them. Now, some of you might say that that's rather obvious. I know exactly who we are, what we represent. Might be, but I think nonetheless, even if it is obvious, it certainly warrants repetition for the sake of our understanding the differences between us and them. And that is a premise that the Torah gives us. Not I, the Bible itself, and a very important one for the sake of our own perpetuation. There was a poll which was conducted recently. All of you know that a few months ago, Gilad Shalit, by the way, I should say very quickly, very briefly, just to tell you about who I am. I've been here before, but very briefly in terms of who I am, where I'm coming from, and one of the reasons I do that is because I really do enjoy speaking about myself. I teach in what's called the Yeshivat Hezder. Yeshivat Hezder, briefly, is a yeshiva which combines Torah study together with serving in combat, elite combat forces in the IDF. So I teach in the yeshiva of Kiryat Gat. It's a branch of Sderot. I'll tell you a little more about it later on. And that's one function that I serve. It's a five-year program. These boys come, they study, but they also serve their country in elite combat forces. And today, especially, in the climate that's going on in Israel today, the division that exists between the secular and the religious, with all the stuff, and I live in Beit Shemesh, and I'm sure you've read all that's what's going on, and unfortunately, a lot of what's been painted in the news is accurate. It's very, very important to sanctify God's name, to show secular Jews that there are religious Jews who are serving in the army and who are or can relate to them, and they're with them, and so on and so forth. So this is a very, very important concept. So that's the first thing, the first capacity that I serve. The second capacity that I serve is I serve under a specific branch in the army, in the Israeli Defense Forces. It's an education branch of the Rabbinate Division. It's called the Harel Division. And we are in charge, there are eight of us, we are in charge with giving lectures to all various divisions throughout the IDF. And the idea is to instill or implant and infuse inside of them the concept of ideology, pioneering spirit. Because today, a bigger threat to Israel's existence, aside from the external enemy of the Arabs who surround us, is really the internal enemy. And if we lose that drive, that desire, that understanding of why an 18 to 21-year-old has to be pulled away from his home, from his family, to make sacrifice at the prime of his youth, and to give over of himself. If they don't understand what they're fighting for, then that is absolutely more compromising to the existence of Israel than any external enemy. And so we are in charge with instilling, infusing them with this pioneering spirit, with this concept that they understand. And by the way, we are not allowed, it's against the law, for us to do so with religious coercion. So it's not what you call in the United States kiruv, you know, telling them to be religious. There's no religious coercion in the army. That's against the law. And we also are not allowed to espouse any of our political, ideas or political supports that we might have. So we have to walk a very fine line in terms of what we say and how we say it. But that's the general idea. And Zionism is fine, depending on how you phrase it and how you talk about it. But this is what we are in charge with doing. So that's where I'm coming from. Well, about 4 months ago now, Gilad Shalit was released. And we all know there was a famous deal which was struck. Thank God he was released. But it was very strange to large parts of the Jewish world. I mean, here you're taking one fellow in exchange for over 1,100 very dangerous fellows who were proven terrorists, who were murderers, who are murderers. And you're making this exchange. And it almost didn't make sense, because when you talk about things on a quantitative measure, it doesn't add up, obviously. Yet, the poll that was conducted popularly of, let's say, 1,500 samples, they asked these people, Israelis, should this be done? Should this change, the exchange be done? 75% of the people said that absolutely it should be done. We should bring Gilad Shalit home and let us change it for 1,100 prisoners. It's fine. But what's interesting is that of those 75%, 66% of that 75% said that even though we feel it should be done, we absolutely feel and we're convinced that inevitably it will result in further attacks, further terrorist attacks. This will result in further murder. So that's an amazing thing. It almost, defies logic. I mean, here's a group of people who clearly predominantly believe that the exchange should be made, but at the same time they're saying that it will absolutely cause an escalation in terrorist attacks. Well, how do you make sense of that? What exactly is the answer? I believe that by the end of the lecture this evening, we'll at least, I don't know if everyone will agree, but at least we'll have a better understanding of where that was coming from and why it had to be done. If we look for a moment, look at the, I'm going to refer to the sources on your sheet in Hebrew, but you're welcome to follow along. There are source sheets that you have in front of you, and these source sheets are in English, and each source that I refer to is in suit with that or in conjunction with those English sources. The Torah tells us the famous story. There's a famous story of Migdal Babel, this Tower of Babel. And we all know that there were these group of people who populated the world. They decided to build this large tower that would go up to God. And that it was considered a rebellion, and the tower was destroyed, and they were not killed, but they were thrown all over the place, mixed up in 70 languages, and so on and so forth. And the question becomes as follows. It's a very fundamental question. What exactly did they do wrong? I mean, if you think about it, in actuality, they should be praised. If I took all of Calabasas Jews, I don't know how many there are, but let's just say I took all of you, and all of you came to California, the California Congress, and said, our goal right now is to build a tower in the middle of Calabasas so that we could find God. I think people would say, well, all the credit to you. I mean, go for it. I think that's a wonderful thing. We need more religion in the United States of America. You're spreading religion. You're looking for God. And even if it symbolizes something, then so be it. I mean, it's a very lovely thing for kids to see people building a tower looking for God. Well, what exactly was wrong with what they did? I think it's a tremendously commendable venture. They threw all their money, all their efforts, all their physicals, everything. And I'll take questions afterwards. So what exactly was going on? Well, here's the problem, you see. The Torah says like this. Look at your verses that you have in front of you in Genesis 12. It says in Bereshit, Vayamru hava nivne lanu iru migdal, v'rosho bashamayma, v'nase lanu shem, v'pen nafutz al pnei kol ha'aretz. Right? Let us build a tower, a city. By the way, I have my cell phone ring in the middle of my lecture so that you know that I am completely Israeli. Okay, let's get this off here. Here we go. Okay, there we go. So sure enough, they say, let's build this tower. What exactly did they do wrong? Well, I'll tell you what they did wrong. Let's envision what was going on here. These people lived during the time of right after the flood of Noah. Now, what exactly did they see with regards to God? It could very well be, and it appears that they did believe in God. But what kind of God? Let's enter their heads, their psyche, for a moment. You know, all that they saw in their entire lives, or all that they heard about, was, yes, there is a God, but what kind of God is it? It is a God of evil. It is a God of destruction. It is a God of wrath, of anger, of revenge. Because every single event that they had heard about until now was death, was a God who exacted punishment on the people around him. Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, they're thrown out of the Garden of Eden, they sin, they bring sin into the world, God throws them out. Cain and Abel, Cain goes ahead, slays his brother Abel, God punishes him, tells him you're a murderer, you're going to wander the face of the earth. Then you got the whole thing with Noah. Noah comes along, the whole world is flooded, completely destroyed, we got to start all over. So these people are saying, you know what, maybe there is a God, but what kind of God is it? It's a very dangerous God. It's a very frightening God. It's a God who premises himself on death. And so what they did was they said, you know what, we're going to build this tower. Well, think about it. What was this tower? In fact, it's actually called a matseva. A matseva, a matseva in modern Hebrew is a tombstone. What they're doing is they're actually trying to build a very large symbol. They're saying to everybody, we know that we're going to die. Inevitably, we're not going to be around for very long. God will exact his revenge on us and we'll move on and get a new civilization. But we want people to know that here laid the following civilization. So we are going to build, not a tower, we are going to build the largest tombstone that anyone could ever see. So that the next civilization who comes along, they'll be able to see the mark of we were once here. It's a marking, a symbol that they were there. And that's what they're trying to build. That's what they're trying to establish. And therefore they built this huge tower so that when they die, because they know that inevitably they will, and God will exact on them that punishment, at least people should know that once they laid here. In fact, it's interesting. That is exactly the reason. The Medrash says that they are criticized because while they were building the tower, people would fall down and they would die and nobody cared. Well, yeah, of course nobody cared because everybody said, here today, gone tomorrow. So he dies today, he died in 2 weeks, he died yesterday, in another 4 months, we'll die. There's no difference there. They all think about death, that inevitably this is what's going to happen. So that's exactly what the Medrash is telling us. Well, the Torah says that God was telling them, oh no, my friends, if you want to establish civilization, if you want to establish the premise of a civilization, that will never, ever, ever be done. with the premise or the basis of death. That is not a marking that I will have in my world. You will never commemorate or consecrate my spirituality or existence through death. And that's exactly what he tells these people. By the way, how? He doesn't kill them. If he would have killed them, he would have destroyed their entire purpose. What does he do? He mixes them up, and he sends them through the faces of the earth, and he says, now you are going to be mixed up with 70 languages, and you are going to learn how to live. And you are going to learn how to build civilization anew. And you are going to find a common way of communique so that you can succeed, ultimately, building up this world for the future. That's exactly what God is trying to tell them. And so what God's message is very clear. The premise of the world will never be built upon death. Martin Gilbert, the famous historian, said, the worst form of child abuse is to teach a child to hate. Well, the Jewish doctrine says the antithesis. We feel that we are progressive and we progress our ways based on the fact that we accentuate life. Radical Islam believes the opposite. Radical Islam believes that we will accentuate life in any way that's possible. We will try to achieve what's called Jannah. Jannah is heaven. And we do that in any way that we can, including by enforcing and promoting the concept of death. That is an antithetical to what Judaism believes. Completely the opposite of what our premise is. And that's exactly what they propose. There's a big debate in terms of the surahs, the chapters of the Quran. There was an abrogation. There are two versions to the Quran which came out, and there's various debates to this day among scholars in terms of which is authentic, which one do you follow, and so on and so forth. In one of those verses, which is adopted by radical Islam, it says very clearly, and I quote you, "Let there be no hostility except to those who practice oppression." Well, who exactly are those who practice oppression? That is very subject to interpretation. Who are the oppressors? Well, I would say an oppressor for the Jewish people would be a Nazi, right? People who killed and gassed Jews. They oppress the Jewish people. I'd say we certainly have our share of oppressors. Now, looking throughout our history, we've got no problem finding any oppressors, people who persecute us. Every single generation, we've had oppressors, and it's not a problem. But oppressors to us means murderers. It means people who either attempted to convert us to their religion or murdered us as such if we were not willing to comply. Well, radical Islam's interpretation of oppression is anyone who does not think or does not subscribe to what they believe in. You are the oppressor. An oppressor is an infidel. An oppressor is someone who is a non-believer. An oppressor, therefore, is Israel or the Jewish people. Regardless of the fact that Israel allows them to religiously practice according to their beliefs, anyone who does not subscribe to their belief and does not embrace the concept of Sharia, right, the law of the Islamic faith, they are considered oppressors. So the moderate Islams will not say that. Moderate Islams will say an oppressor is someone who does not allow you to practice your faith. Radical Islam says that an oppressor is someone who does not practice your faith. And that becomes the subject of a very, very sore issue. Well, if we go further in the Parshat Akedah, we see that this exact premise was established. If you look at the next source on your sheet, the Torah tells us the famous story of Avram Avinu, Abraham, our forefather, when he was told by God to take his son Isaac to sacrifice. The Torah tells us in chapter 22, and I'd like to read it, bear with me for a moment. I'll read it in Hebrew. The Torah tells us that Avram and Isaac was walking with two other people. There were four people who were present at this Akedah, this sacrifice of Isaac, supposed, proposed sacrifice of Isaac. Those were Abraham, Isaac, obviously, Yishmael, and Eliezer, the faithful servant of Abraham. Four of them were walking together. And on the third day, Abraham looks heavenwards, and he sees the place where he's supposed to perform this proposed sacrifice, because God never tells him exactly where he's supposed to go. It's not clear. He looks towards the heavens, and obviously what's going on is that he's not seeing a physical place where he's supposed to sacrifice his son. He sees a spiritual place. He has spiritual revelation that this is the place where he's supposed to be. And interestingly enough, by the way, it took the Jewish people 3 days to prepare for spiritual revelation at Mount Sinai. to prepare for the revelation at Sinai for the Torah. Very similar to what Abraham experienced as well in his own personal life in this parsha of the Akedah, the sacrifice of his son Isaac. Third day he looks up, and the Torah tells us that he turns to two other people, to Ishmael and to Eliezer, his servant. And he says like this, he says, Shvu lachem po im hachamor v'ani v'anar nelcha ad ko, v'nishtachave v'nashuva aleichem. It's actually quite insulting. He says to Ishmael and to Eliezer, he says, you know, you guys, you hang out with a donkey, and I and my son, we're going to go talk to God. So you hang out in the barn, play with the animals, while we go and search for spirituality. Well, there are many who explain that what exactly is this chamor? Chamor means donkey. But donkey is always a symbol of chomer. Chomer in Hebrew actually means physicality. Physicality. And it was exactly here that Abraham said, there's a difference between you and me. Eliezer is his servant. He's not worthy yet to see this revelation of God, and so he leaves him behind. But Ishmael, there was an absolute proposed plan to what Abraham was doing here. Abraham was clearly telling Ishmael that there is a difference between you and me. You will search for and you will receive from God chomer, chamor, physical entities of this world. You will enjoy the materialistic benefits of what the world has to offer. Namely, every single oil field exists in the Arab lands. That's exactly what happened. In fact, they hold the entire world hostage, including the United States, because of the fact that they have all or the most of the oil in the world. And I was at this place in Israel called Better Place. I don't know if you went there. It's called the Better Place. They made an electric car. The truth is that it's not economically viable right now. It doesn't make 100% sense, but they developed it. They developed the electric car, and even though it's not 100% economically viable, they sell it, and part of it is that we no longer want to be held hostage by the Arab world. We want to be able to run our cars without gas and to run things without oil, and this is part of the issue. Well, sure enough, Abraham knew that. Abraham said, you will get the chamor, you'll get the chomer, you'll get the physical, you'll have the comfort, you'll have the materialism, you'll have the wealth. We're looking for something else. We're going to go bow down to God. Well, bowing down to God, what does that get you? Does it get you any material benefits? Does it get you any wealth? You ever meet a wealthy rabbi? You ever meet a rabbi in any synagogue who doesn't go to his members and say, we need money? You ever meet any yeshiva in the world who says, oh, you know, we don't need your donation. We're quite comfortable. We're very, very wealthy. As a matter of fact, let us give you so we can help your financial situation. It never, ever happened and never will happen in history. Why? Because God says spiritual institutions are not built that way. Spiritual institutions, you don't get the oil. You're going to have to go out. You're going to have to be part of things. You have to feel a kinship to what's going on and so forth. That's the premise that Abraham establishes here. But it goes even further than that. You see, because when Abraham leaves Ishmael, he takes Isaac up the mountain. And we all know that he was about to slaughter his son, but he doesn't do it. But what does it say? You can look at the verse that you have in your second sheet. In the Hebrew it says, and you can read it in English, the angel comes to Abraham and he says, Al tishlech yadcha el anar ve'al tas lo mi'uma. Do not lay a hand upon the lad, do nothing to him. For now I know that you are a God-fearing man. Now obviously this is repetitive. Why does it say, lay not your hand upon the lad, do nothing to him? If you tell me not to lay my hand upon the lad, I know that I'm not supposed to do anything to him. So why do you need to say both things? The Medrash says that when God first told him, lay not a finger upon the lad, Abraham said, oh, I know you already. You're testing me. Everything's a test. You want to see if I'll really do this. You know what? I'm going to show you. And Abraham went forward, according to the Medrash, with a knife and was going to actually nick the child. And he said, I'm going to show you that I'm completely prepared to sacrifice my son for you. It was then that the malach, the angel, said again, Al taslo mi'uma. No, I don't think you understand me. Do not touch that child. It is exactly here that God demonstrates the difference between Jewish faith and radical Islam. Because you see, Judaism says you can never, ever, ever sanctify God's existence by laying injury upon a child. And Islamic faith says and advocates that you should injure yourself for the sake of consecrating God's existence. As a matter of fact, you there's no shortage of videos, of YouTube videos and footage that you could see children being brought in by Hamas, by Hezbollah, by Fatah, and so on and so forth, and telling, teaching them, training them, I want to be a holy martyr for the sake of Allah, I will blow up myself, and they have grenades and they have machine guns around them. We've seen all the footages. And that's exactly what exists. As a matter of fact, that's part of their education. They teach them to believe and subscribe to that. As a matter, it's interesting. In the third grade book to this day in Palestinian history books, which is taught in Israel, by the way, for some strange reason, in third grade, they learn that the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 was a Nakba, which means a catastrophe. Now, nowhere will you find in any, as far as I know, in Jewish literature, that the establishment of Islamic countries or Islam or belief in Muhammad is a catastrophe. Because we don't really care. You can believe in whatever you want. You know, go for it. Have a good time. Knock yourself out. But we don't say that it's a catastrophe. We say you're wrong. We don't agree with you. But you can choose to believe in what you want to believe. That they have the mantra that this is a catastrophe. It's a very, very different type of approach. Because to them, that is exactly what I described a few moments ago. That is the definition of the oppressor. Someone who does not believe and subscribe to what they believe in. And that becomes very, very problematic. It's interesting, there was an Al Jazeera, which is the one of the Arabic-based television stations. There was a program which was aired prior to Passover. I think this goes back, two years ago. And it was an entire play, a program, a movie about blood libels. And it shows how Hasidic Jews with payas, how they go ahead and they slaughter, it actually has the complete drama, they slaughter a child, they take the blood, it's very graphic, they show the blood coming out of his neck, they take the blood and they bake the matzahs with the blood, and they try to sell it to an Arab, and the Arab says it tastes funny. It's a whole program, and it really depicts this entire thing. So there was a fellow, I don't know if you heard of him, his name is Walid Shobat. Walid Shobat was a former PLO terrorist. And he goes around speaking, a very interesting guy, goes around speaking about he was wrong. He retracts all of the doctrine that he was taught was completely wrong, completely off. And he goes around speaking about this. And he says that based on this film, this thing with the blood libel, he says, we accuse the Jews of doing exactly what we do ourselves. In other words, we talk about the Jews who slaughtered their children, who sacrificed children, who slaughter other people's children. And yet he says, that's what we do. We take our children and teach them and infuse them with this doctrine that they have to go out and commit suicide murder, suicide martyrdom for the sake of getting into Jannah, into Islamic heaven. And this is a very, very serious, dangerous problem that exists. There was an article which appeared by Evelyn Gordon in the Jerusalem Post. This goes back about 5 years ago. And she spoke about why are we willing to still celebrate Yom Yerushalayim, Jerusalem Day, even though there were a number of terrorist attacks which had taken place. And she explains like this, and I'll read you part of the article. She says, after 13-year-old Kobe Mandel, and that should ring a bell, was bludgeoned to death by terrorists in 2001, for instance, his parents decided to set up a foundation to help other victims of terror. After 15-year-old Malki Roth was murdered in a suicide bombing in Jerusalem that same year, her parents established a foundation to help families care for special needs children at home. When Benji Hillman was killed in combat in Lebanon last summer, his parents decided to memorialize him, this was the second Lebanon war, memorialize him by establishing a home for lone soldiers, where soldiers without families in Israel can stay during times and be fed, get their laundry done, and receive other services that their families are not there to supply. And after Jonathan Einhorn fell in Lebanon last summer, his parents decided to use the compensation money they will receive from the government to build a public garden of native Israeli plant life, a place of beauty that everyone will be able to enjoy, which will memorialize their son's love of the land. This response to grief, and there are numerous similar examples, is particularly noteworthy when contrasted with a phenomenon unknown amongst Israelis but not uncommon on the Palestinian side. Parents who respond to a child's death by publicly urging their other children to court similar deaths. After her 17-year-old son, Mohammed, was killed in the process of murdering five Israeli teens in 2002, for instance, Umnidil Farahat of Gaza proudly told a Saudi newspaper that she had discussed the attack with him in advance and even posed for keepsake photos. Similarly, after suicide bomber Saeed Qutari murdered 21 Israelis at a Tel Aviv discotheque, if you remember that was on a Friday night in the Dolphinarium, in 2002, his father Hassan declared, "I was very happy when I heard that it was my son who carried out the attack," and added that he would be proud to have all of his other sons be suicide bombers as well. In the biblical book of Deuteronomy, Devarim, Moses lays down a challenge from God to the Jewish people, which we'll see at the end. "I have set before you life and death, the blessings and the curse, therefore choose life." My dear friends, this is exactly what makes the difference between us and Islamic or radical Islam. We sanctify God through life. They consecrate God's existence by embracing and inviting death. And that is a major area of confrontation, a major conflict that exists between the two faiths. But there is another fundamental which is very important for us to be aware, particularly that the Torah, the Bible, is very aware of and very wary of with regards to what we call radical, what we call kana'ut. Kana'i, in loosely translated in Hebrew, means extremism, an extremist. What exactly or how exactly does the Torah approach this type of or this label of an extremist, an extremism? What exactly is that? So if you look at your third source down, this is taken from Pinchas. And in Bamidbar it tells us, the classic Kana'i, the classic radical person that we're familiar with was this fellow Pinchas, who went ahead and he saw that one of the leaders of the tribes of Israel was behaving improperly, sexually promiscuous, and he got up and he took a spear and rammed the spear through this fellow and the girl, and thereby sanctified God's name in front of all of the children of Israel. I mean, he just knocked them out. And the Torah says like this. The Bible says, it opens up the parsha, this portion of Pinchas. Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, follow along in the third source in English. Heshivet chamati mi'al b'nei Yisrael, has turned my wrath away from the children of Israel. Bekano et kinati betocham. Right? When he is very jealous for my sake amongst them, so that I consume not the children of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore, says God, Lachein Amor, let it be said, Hineni noten lo et briti shalom. I therefore am giving him or proposing to him to give him shalom, peace. What is the Torah telling us when it proposes these verses of the fact that Pinchas, this apparently radical human being who kills the head of this tribe in one false swoop, but at the same time the Torah inculcates and includes within what Pinchas did, briti, the covenant of what? Shalom, peace. The reason why the Torah does this is because the Torah wants us to understand that kina, extremism, radicalism, is never acceptable. And the only way that we see it within the context of mankind is when it is coupled together with a concept called shalom, peace. In other words, we are never allowed to act extreme. We are never allowed to act radical. When we do act radical, the few times that we may be allowed to do so, it must be coupled with a judgment of peace. We have to assess that action based on peace. What are my incentives? What are my motives? When I'm acting extreme, when I'm acting radical, what am I trying to do? If I'm trying to instill peace in this world, if I'm trying to promote a peaceful existence, then I have the right to decide whether or not to behave as such. But if my actions will be translated as volatile or violent or indifferent, then that becomes problematic, and I am not allowed to instill this concept or to introduce a concept of kana'i, of being radical, of being extremist. This is a very important fundamental with regards to Judaism. And it's interesting. When we talk about kin'ah, this radical extremism, generally speaking, it is coupled in the Torah, in the Bible, with negative experiences. For example, classic place where it appears is with a woman who's called a sotah. A woman who has behaved promiscuously or is accused of behaving promiscuously by her husband. It says, Bikano, what does he have? Vara lav ruach kin'ah. The father has, the husband rather, has this air of extreme jealousy amongst them, and therefore he accuses his wife as such. Kinah is not a good thing. In fact, the Torah, the Bible, the Medrash tells us, the Talmud tells us, that when people divorce, when they do not or cannot have a happy existence in their marriage, the Mizbeach, the altar in the Temple Mount, cries over them. And obviously demonstrating the fact that God is upset that they weren't able to get along and so on and so forth, demonstrating or representing the marriage that God has with his Jewish people, that if you can't get along amongst them, then I have a problem getting along with you, and so on and so forth on a larger scale. But this concept of kinah, this concept of radicalism or extremism, is generally not accepted in Judaism. In fact, the few places, or one of the few places where it is written within the verse and text of the Torah of the Bible, is God is described as El Kano V'Nokem. He is described as a Lord, a God who exacts judgment. And we give it to God, but we do not ascribe it to people, because that is not up to us to be able to decide when we should behave as such, in such a radical or extreme fashion. Islam has a concept called submission. Radical Islam has a concept called submission. It's brought down a number of times without the Quran. And that means that, again, you must submit to my belief. You must subscribe to my belief. If you do not do so, then you are an oppressor, that you are not accepted. Judaism never, ever, ever had the concept of proselytizing. As a matter of fact, we discourage people to convert to Judaism. We don't encourage it. We don't want it. And we never go out and force people to the Jewish faith. Anyone who wants to be Jewish, anyone who is Jewish, so we try to embrace them and teach them about Judaism. But anyone who's not, we certainly don't go out and proselytize and convince them otherwise. I had a very interesting experience. I was flying back to Israel once. And there was a group of BYU students, Brigham Young University students, all about 35 Mormons on the plane. And, you know, what's really annoying is that they're just beautiful people. They're all blonde, blue eyes. They're clearly not Jewish. And it's just, you know, and they're all sitting there and, you know, you're going gaga over these people. And they all, you know, look like the models of existence. And I was sitting next to, unfortunately I might add, I was sitting next to a guy as opposed to a girl. And this guy sitting next to me, he's a very good-looking guy. And, you know, he strikes up conversation with me. I'm talking to him. So I said to him, look, I'll tell you, you know, he said to me, I'm so excited. I'm going to Israel. This is fantastic. I can't wait. My first time going to Israel. I said to him, you know, I'll tell you the truth, my friend. In all due respect, you know, I really can't share your enthusiasm. It doesn't make me very happy. And he said, why? Why not? What's the problem? I said, well, I know that the Mormons and their faith, when you reach a certain age, I think it's 20 or something like that, you have to go out and actively proselytize. You have to convert people to Mormonism for 2 years. They're actually required to do that. So I said, I know why you're coming to Jerusalem. You're coming to Jerusalem to knock on Jewish doors and to convince us to be Mormons. So he said, oh, no, we have an agreement with the Israeli government that we'll never do that. We'll come, but we will not proselytize actively. I said, yeah, but, you know, come on, you're going to be there for 2 years. How are you going to control yourself? I mean, come on, it's part of your religion. This is what you got to do. I mean, you know, it's going to happen. So I said, look, I said, besides, I don't really understand you. I said, why do you have to do that? I mean, you know, Mormons could be Mormons and Jews could be Jews. What do you have to make us Mormons for? Just leave us alone. We're Jewish, so that's what we believe in. Leave us. What do you have to drive us crazy for? There's enough Mormons, that very wealthy community. I mean, what's the problem? We try to look for donations by Jews. That's the wrong place to go. So I don't really understand. Why are you doing this? So he said to me like this. He said, well, we feel that we know the key to happiness. And we want to share that happiness with you as well. So I said, let me tell you something, my friend. I said, I'm flying on a plane. I am by myself. My wife and six children are 6,000 miles away, and I'm drinking a whiskey. I know what happiness is. You don't need to teach me what happened. I have found true happiness and bliss, and I don't need you to teach me it, right? But that's the truth. I mean, you know, but this is a concept that Judaism never subscribed to. And what's interesting is that Pinchas, the same priest of Pinchas, who was a priest, was his entire existence is predicated upon what we call shalom, peace. In fact, the blessing that the Kohanim, the priests, give us when they say Yivarech Hashem v'yishmerecha, and they bless the Jewish people, the final blessing is V'yaseim lecha shalom. We should be able to grant you, and we should all be blessed with peace. Peace is what we bless ourselves with. Peace is what we are longing for. Peace is what we try to disseminate to the people around us. That is not a word that enters the vernacular of a radical Islam. The late Sheikh Yassin said that modern operations are absolutely legitimate and they are what should be enacted. And Lahavdil, when we talk about in Judaism, acts of extremism, that is not acceptable. We'll take a typical example just for a moment because I don't want to segue into this. It's a huge topic, and that is the issues of what's going on in my hometown of Beit Shemesh. These people who are radically extreme, who implement radical extreme behaviors that are not acceptable by any part, any stream of Judaism, including Black Hat Jews, Zionist Jews, non-religious Jews, religious Jews, it doesn't matter. Everybody agrees that these kinds of methods, which I don't want to go into detail with, but trust me, it's my daughter's school and I've been there and I see what goes on, is not a Jewish thing. It's not acceptable. There are children who walk around in Beit Shemesh, I kid you not, they are smothered in clothing more than the most religious, fundamental Islamic person. And they walk around and you see them completely covered, including their faces. You cannot see a thing on their body, including their hands. They wear gloves and they cover their faces. And all you see are these little sneakers sticking out of their feet. And it's like, you cry because it is absolute physical abuse. It's abusive to a child to treat them that way. And this is what's going on. But that's not a Jewish thing. That's a, you know, someone who behaves as such doesn't need a rabbi. They need a psychiatrist. It's a very serious problem. So Judaism never advocates that type of behavior. And what's interesting is, I want to point out, if you look for a moment at your next source, it says in Numbers 25, this is number 4, source number 4, with regards to Pinchas, the Torah tells us that when he calculated his decision, where was it coming from? It was coming from as follows. This is chapter 25. I'll just open up the Hebrew here. Vayakom Pinchas, Vayar Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, Pinchas the son of Elazar, the priestly Kohen, priest, sees. Vayakom mitoch ha'eda, he gets up and rose up from the midst of the congregation. The rabbis ask, what congregation was he getting up from? And the rabbis explain, when we talk about eda, a congregation, that's classically referring to a Jewish court of law. In other words, Pinchas' assessment of what had to be done was not done off a whim. It was not done as an uncalculated decision. He made a calculated decision based on his assessment and conferring together with his colleagues in a Jewish court of law. It was then when they came to the conclusion that, yes, this is acceptable for you to do such an action, only based on discussion with other rabbinic figures, did he then take the act of this killing of this leader of one of the tribes of Israel. And so it's very important for us to realize that radicalism, extremism, is never advocated in Judaism, rarely. And if it is, it must be done with extreme consultation and together coupled with the concept of shalom for the sake of peace. Having said that, what's also interesting is that we have to realize another important point, and that is that even shalom, peace within the Jewish people, also cannot be extreme. And what I mean by that is that from the other side, you can't be an extreme peacenik. In other words, we have no problem with making peace. We want to make peace. We want there to be peace. But when peace translates as compromising everything that you have and putting people's lives in danger, that's not peace. That's extremism. And that also is not acceptable. I don't know if you recall, a few months ago, there was a very funny episode. It was actually, I don't know if it's funny or sad. There was a, Barack Obama went into the private room in France with Sarkozy. And they didn't realize that their microphones were still on. You remember this?
Yeah.
And Sarkozy said that, you know, oh, I really think that Netanyahu is a liar. I don't trust the man. And Obama said, oh, tell me about it. I got to deal with him every single week. And the microphones were on. I don't know. God is absolutely cracking up upstairs. I mean, look at it. It didn't even make like such an impact on the world. But whatever it is. So after that happened, Tippi Livni stupidly came out with a remark. She said, right afterwards, she said, on this day, when this had happened, she said, I am embarrassed to be a Jew. Right? Why is she embarrassed to be a Jew? Because Sarkozy and Obama were criticizing her leader, our Prime Minister Netanyahu, for no reason, and talking about him, bad-mouthing him behind closed doors, which they thought was... I mean, so why are you embarrassed? You don't have to be embarrassed to be a Jew. You have to be proud to be a Jew. So when we start making these concessions and we start apologizing with our tail behind our legs and saying, we're so sorry for being Jewish, that's also radicalism. That's also extremism. That type of peace is not acceptable. So peace has to also be calculated. And that's exactly what we learn from this Pinchas, who decided to take action based only on that calculated decision. Therefore, the Torah ensures that there are preventive measures so that these actions will be avoided. And where do we see this classically? Unbelievable insight. We look at Chronicles 22. And in Chronicles, Divrei Hayamim 22, King David longed to build the temple. He wanted to build the first temple to the Jewish people, and God denied him the ability to do so. Now, it's interesting. In Shmuel, the first time that King David arrives on the scene, in Shmuel, the first time it's recording about the life of King David, it says nothing about King David's desire to build the temple, and it says nothing about why he was denied. But in Chronicles, which appears later, it does say, it says, but the word of the Lord, this is number 5, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, you have shed blood abundantly and have made great wars. You shall not build a house to my name because you have shed much blood upon the earth in my sight. Now this is David talking to himself. And this is David giving response as to why he was not allowed to build the temple. This does not appear the first time that we record David's life in Shmuel and Samuel. What was going on here? What exactly did David do wrong? In fact, it's quite clear. It seems that David was denied, and we're always taught this. He was denied to build the temple because he shed too much blood. He was a warrior. He was a conqueror. He fought wars. He shed a lot of blood. He killed a lot of people during the time of warfare. But on the other hand, I mean, we're not talking about a blood-sucking conqueror. We're not talking about, who am I thinking of who's that famous conqueror? You know, we always talk. Whatever it is, we're not talking about one of these people who are going. What? No. Attila the Hun, right? We're not talking about Attila the Hun over here. We're talking about. Thank you. We're not talking about Attila the Hun. We're talking about King David. King David was a scholar. King David was a tzaddik. He was a righteous individual. He was a brilliant individual. He was close to God. Spoke to God. He was a prophet. I mean, we're not talking about a simpleton here. He was a very, very holy person and a great leader of the Jewish people. And he was able to combine, by the way, the fine balance of being a physical conqueror and a spiritual leader, which is very, very hard to do. And yet he is denied. Why? Why is he denied? You would think that he wrote the book of Psalms, which talks about peace, which talks about subscribing to God's existence, give him the right to build the temple. Why is he denied? And there are two explanations that I want to share with you. The Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, says a tremendous insight. He says, there's no question that David's slaying of people, killing people in warfare, was excusable because that was part of what had to be done. Nonetheless, and I'm going to quote you what he says and I'll translate. Shfichut damim larov mna'o milivnot beit hamikdash. Killing too many. Murdering too many, it obstructed him from being allowed to build the temple. Now, he doesn't say from being allowed to build the temple. He actually says obstructed him from building the temple. There's a difference. If I were to say to you it obstructed him from being allowed, that would be from God. If I said if I obstructed him from building the temple, it would be from him. Why? Beit HaMikdash hu l'shalom u'lekapara u'le'ateret tefillah. Beit HaMikdash, the temple, is for the sake of instilling, first thing he says, peace. For the sake of instilling respect and reverence of God, and for the sake of promoting prayer. And it seems that David felt a guilty conscience to engage myself in peace and in prayer and in embracing God and religiosity and sanctity when I've spilled so much blood. It's a contradiction. I can't possibly instill and infuse both those concepts together. And so David is told he cannot do so, or he feels that he was unable to do so. It's a tremendous, tremendous insight. But there's another reason that is also very revealing. And this is based on a great scholar called Rabbi Yonatan Eibeschitz. Rabbi Yonatan Eibeschitz lived in the 18th century. And he says like this. He says, the rabbis say that they told, that God told David, Amcha Yisrael tzrichin parnasa. Your Jewish people need money. They need sustenance. What happened? The Medrash explains that after David slew Goliath, he was smoldered and adorned with tons of gold. I had an amazing experience, by the way. I just was in, it was in Phoenix, Arizona. And at the end of one of my lectures, I made a pitch, which I'll do tonight as well, about offering a donation to our yeshiva in Kiryat Gat, these boys who fight, and they, et cetera, et cetera. And okay, guy comes over. This guy came to two of my lectures. He came to one of my lectures early in the day. He said, I love it. Where else are you speaking? I told you I'll speak at this place. And I told him you can come. And he showed up. And at the end of the lecture, people are gathering around looking at my stuff. And he comes by and he drops a coin in my pocket. And he says, here, this is for you. Don't tell anybody. So me, right, in typical human fashion, I'm thinking to myself, this guy just gave me a quarter for a donation for the yeshiva. I mean, like, first of all, I can't even use coins in Israel. So what am I supposed to do exactly? They don't accept coins either. Second of all, like, a quarter? I mean, like, anyway, just to show you God's sense of humor, I take the coin out when I leave everybody, and I look at it, and I've never seen this coin in my life. It's a small gold coin. It's a $5 coin. $5 coin. Ever hear of a $5 coin? Right, because they don't make them anymore. $5 coin made of pure gold from 1907. I go on the internet, it's worth a couple of $100. So, like, you know, here I am, yeah, I could have had a V8, and I think to myself, you got to look at people in the right way. I'm thinking like a quarter, and the guy's giving me, whatever it is. So, sure enough, David goes ahead, he's smoldered with gold. People threw gold at him because of the fact that he defeated Goliath. What did he do with this gold? What David did was, he amassed this wealth, and he reserved it for the construction of the temple. Now, we would think that's very altruistic. What a tremendous thing. He took the gold and he said, I'm going to build a temple with it. So he put it aside. But the problem is that there were many Jewish people who needed livelihood. They needed sustenance. And David would not give it to them. He said, I'll give you what I can, but this is reserved for the construction of the temple. And that's what David meant when he said that I shed blood. It's not that he killed the Gentiles. It's not that he killed the non-Jews in war. It's that he was killing his own people. That he was not sensitive to their needs by providing for them. Judaism is absolutely based on the concept of sensitivity. That we are always giving. That we are always worrying. That we are always sustaining. That's why you can walk into a synagogue. It's an amazing thing. I've seen this. If you go in certain synagogues and you tell them, look, we got a very serious problem. We need this amount of money. Cough it up. And Jews will. They'll cough it up. Because there's a sense of community. There's a sense of we must take care of the urgent matter at hand. Now I ask you, one of the most amazing, confounding things that you have with regards to Gaza. Prior to the IDF Tzahal going into Gaza for Operation Cast Lead, there were over $100 million by the world community poured into the Arabs, the Palestinians, so to speak, in Gaza. And that was given to them for infrastructure, for education, for economic development, for resources. And it was almost all of it was used for the sake of building the Philadelphia corridor, smuggling tunnels to bring more weapons of mass destruction to be able to attack Israel. And as a matter of fact, I just heard, recently that there are Islamic leaders who say explicitly that if you gave us the option, oh, you know what, I heard it from my brother, he's a professor, I heard it in one of his lectures. He said there was, I have to ask him who it was. It was an Islamic leader who said, explicitly said, if you give me the option of oppressing my people or of giving them the financial needs to have security, but on the expense of allowing Israel to survive, I'll take the oppression of my people so that I never admit to Israel the right to exist. And that is a very radical Islamic mantra, a radical Islamic way of existing. That is not something that Judaism embraces. In fact, King David was told that he could not build a temple because of his lack of sensitivity to his own people. Forget about people that are around him. And therefore, in Leviticus it says, and with this we'll conclude in 2 moments. In Leviticus it says, fascinating thing. It says, moreover, number 6, you shall say to the children of Israel, whosoever be of the children of Israel or of the strangers that sojourn in Israel, that give of his seed unto Molech. What is this Molech? And by the way, it's not translated because that's what it was. Molech, there's a debate amongst the Rishonim, amongst some of the outstanding scholars, what exactly this Molech was. According to Rabbeinu Bachye, it wasn't this, but according to some, it was. And that was that they would take children and they would sacrifice them. It was child sacrifice. So the Torah says, if you do this, he shall surely be put to death. And who puts these people to death? Someone who does the Molech, a Jew, who sacrifices his child. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. That means, Am Haaretz Yirgamuhu Ba'avanim. Now let us understand what that means. Am Haaretz, the people of the land. Normally we talk about an Am Haaretz, we say, oh, he doesn't know how to learn. He doesn't know any Talmud. He's an Am Haaretz. But here, actually, Am Haaretz is a positive thing. It's not a negative connotation. It's a positive compliment. Am Haaretz means the people who civilize the world, the land, the people who settle the land, none other than the Jewish people. The greatest value that we have is life. The greatest mitzvah that we have is to have produce children, puruvu, to be fruitful and multiply, to bring life into this world. That is the most important mitzvah commandment that we have. Why? Because we are in charge with settling this world, with enhancing civilization in this world. A person who takes a child and sacrifices him is a person who does the antithesis. He attempts to destroy civilization, not enhance it. And that is not acceptable. And therefore, the same Am Haaretz, the same people who look to settle the land, they will stone the person with avanim, with these stones. Why a stone? Why an evan? So if you look at the word avanim, evan, stone in Hebrew, evan comes from 2 words. Very interesting. Evan comes from the word evne, which means construction. And evan in Hebrew, if you take aleph, bet, nun, and you split it apart, it becomes 2 words. Aleph, bet, av, ev, bet, nun, ven, ev, ven, father, abba, ben, father, son. That is why he has to be killed with the avanim, because he is reminded, and the Jewish people are reminded as such, that there is nothing more important in this world than establishing the future of Jewish civilization, establishing the future of father, son, of continuing and perpetuating future Jewish generations. That is our mission in life, to develop a civilized world, and that is the concept. Well, there was a commentary, comment made from one of the Islamic philosophers called Al-Ansari Kuwait. And she said, our children know how to die for Allah, but the challenge that we have in Islamic faith is, do our children know how to live for Allah? Well, that's exactly what we do in Judaism. We teach our children to live for the sake of God, not, God forbid, to die for the sake of God. And the most difficult challenge that Chayalei Tzva Hagana Yisrael, that Israeli soldiers had, he asked them during the war in Gaza, is that they could not believe that people, soldiers or Hamas terrorists, would actually take children, grab them, and walk across the street with the child in front of them in order to shield themselves from bullets or from harm's way. It was absolutely unfathomable to them. I have a good friend of mine, Ben Weisblatt. He was a commander during this operation. He said it was just so warped to see people use children as human shields. It was, I think that was more distracting to them than the battle itself. They couldn't get a hold. It was like psychologically ill. It was a completely, you know, just a warped concept in humanism, human understanding, that Judaism would never, ever even fathom, think about. That Hamas terrorists would harbor themselves in a school with children inside so that the Israeli soldiers would not bomb, or that the Israeli Air Force would not bomb such an area. It's unbelievable. So this is the concept that is very, very opposite to how Jewish people think. Part of our concept, part of our what we embrace in our belief, is that we are involved, immersed in yeshuvo shel olam, in settling this world, in enhancing civilization, not only avoiding destruction, but really ensuring a construction. And that's why I want to end with the following verse, the final one, number 7 on your sheet, where the Torah clearly says, "See, I have set before you this day life and good. Chayim v'tov, achayim v'atov, v'ein atati lefanecha. See that I have set before you achayim v'atov, life and good." One of the questions which is posed by the Klei Yochar on this verse is, why does it say chayim, life, and then tov, good? You would think that good should come first. No, because in other words, good is the way that we should live our life. And then, so to say, I have placed before you goodness and life. Life follows. And the Klei Yochar explains that no, the entire reason that we are given the right to live is exclusively to produce tov, good, in this world. And the moment that we are not involved in that mission is the moment that we've missed the boat, is the moment that we no longer have right to exist in our lives. Without tov, without good, we have no reason to live. And therefore, it says at the end, that I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. Therefore, choose life, that you may live, you and your seed after you. Rav Moshe Feinstein asks, why does it have to say to us, Bacharta Bachayim, choose life? I mean, is that not rather an obvious directive? If you put in front of me death or life, well, of course I'm going to choose life. Why would anyone think otherwise? I mean, we want to live long lives. We want to live productive lives, healthy lives. Why does the Torah need to give us that direction? And Rav Moshe explains, it is only given to us for the latter part of the verse, where it clearly says, you and your seed after you. Why do you live? You live for the sake of your seed. You live for the sake of your children. You live for the sake of producing and perpetuating a future. You live for the sake of facilitating and prolonging generations. This is the Jewish concept. This is the difference between us and a radical Islamic faith, which clearly is willing and able and purports to sacrifice its youth for the sake of getting to spirituality. We say no, we embrace life. That's what we choose, for the sake of producing good, for the sake of producing a future. So Yehi Ratzon, it should be the will of God that we should all merit being able to subscribe to this type of belief, to continue to live our lives as Jewish people, which means that we are attempting to instill more good in this world, to attempting to enhance civilization, and as a result of that, we should all see shalom, peace, al Yisrael, amen. I'm very happy to take some questions, and I'll just mention very quickly that you thought you'd get away from me, but in the back outside, there are, I have only one of my books with me, so you're more than welcome to take a look at the books. I sell them at a very discounted price, as well as other lecture CDs of different topics. Part of the proceeds of both of these go towards helping and supporting our yeshiva in Israel. As I mentioned, these are boys who really are underachievers academically. They're from Sephardic backgrounds. They have not. They do not pay tuition. They do not have the financial means to do so. We worry after them. We have 85 students now. We went from 12 our first year to 85. And they are not only studying in yeshiva, but they are serving in combat forces in the IDF. And we instill them with what's most important, which is a sense of self-security. And we encourage them to go on to pursue academics afterwards and to become outstanding civilians in Israeli society. So please, if you want to look at those goods, if you would like to offer a donation, that would be most appreciated. And finally, I'll mention that there are some of my cards out there. I do make part of my livelihood by running around like a nutcase speaking in many places. So if you know of other relatives, friends, other communities, connections that you might have that you might want to recommend me to, please take my card. It's all about networking. I would very much appreciate that. and it will be helpful to me as well if you feel that you'd like to do so. Questions, if there are any. Yes. I knew you'd have one.
And it's Donna.
Yes, Donna, that's right, yes.
Yeah, thank you, that I'm right.
It's been a few years, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, of course. How successful are the Mormons when they go to Israel, knocking on the doors?
It's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if they have statistics. I don't know if they have numbers. I don't know. But, you know, the fact that they're... Look, I mean, I obviously have no problem with Mormons coming to visit Israel. It's good. But they also give financially, economically, it also helps the country. But I do have a problem if they're going to proselytize, anyone who proselytizes. By the way, it's unbelievable. This is an unbelievable thing. My wife was at... in the summer, she was at a swimming pool. She's a member of... she has a membership with the kids to the swimming pool. At the entrance to Shar Hagai, which is the from Jerusalem highway going towards Beit Shemesh. And she's sitting at the swimming pool, and she overheard an Israeli woman sitting right next to her on the phone saying, oh, so we're having the meeting tonight? It's a big meeting. And, my wife really is not really, a gooseberry or one of those, people who minds people's business. She's kind of like, pretty cool that way. But she thought maybe she's missing like a big meeting going on in Beit Shemesh or something. So she asked, oh, what meeting is there tonight? She said, "Well, it's Jews for Jesus." So she said, "What?" And this is an Israeli woman. So she said, "What? There's a chapter of that here?" She said, "Oh yeah, it's huge. We have a whole chapter here. We have one in Beit Shemesh, and we have a meeting tonight, and we have many youth who are involved." And my wife was just like, she called me right away. She said, "I can't believe this." I mean, she was in shock. And we don't see all these things that are going on around us, but they are prevalent, and it's we have to be aware of them. So I don't know the numbers, but it definitely is. I mean, what better place to proselytize than the Holy Land? I mean, that's to bring people back,
Donna,
so to speak.
What percentage of the Mormons that go over there become Jews?
That would be a nice thought. None.
How many guys? I don't know. I don't know about that one.
But kudos to you.
Spent 2 years in Israel, you never know.
But when you spoke up to him, I was surprised you did, but also that was great.
It made the flight interesting. Yes.
You said you weren't going to mention statistics, but I did see something recently which is rather interesting, which showed that actually the United States is the lowest percentage of Muslims. I think according to the statistics which I actually have here, we have here 0.6% of the population. The United States, which is 330 million people, but only 0.6% of those are Muslims. Now, they say also that at 2%, when it becomes 2%, that's when it starts to get a little bit dangerous. And for instance, I can tell you that in France they have 8%. So you were saying, you were saying that it's too late for Europe. Most European countries are between 5% and 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it was just an interesting statistic. But mm-hmm. I think that we're very fortunate here that it's so low.
Yeah, but the thing is that what you have to look at. Okay, so that's true. But what you have to look at is what's being done in order for their future. In other words, what seeds are they planting so that those... I mean, 20 years ago, there was the same was said about Europe. I mean, nobody would have dreamt that there would be a 10% population of Islam in Europe. Mm-hmm. And, so that's really what you have to ask yourself, right? I mean, also, I think, bless you, one of the disturbing things is, after 9/11, so everybody goes, we're all waking up, we're all realizing... Americans really, really consciously choose not to see what's going on. It's really part of the culture, because we like to live in a comfortable. There's a comfort zone that exists, and the fact that geographically the United States of America is really removed from the rest of the world. So, you become comfortable that way. And I think that's what you have to ask. What's going to be, I'm talking about 20 years down the line, 25 years down the line, it's not a long time, it's like, it's like tomorrow. What's going to be then? And what kind of, and you see that there are cells which are being planted throughout the United States.
We see what's happening in the Middle Eastern countries.
Yeah.
Look at what's going on in Egypt, that's 99% Muslim.
Right.
And look what's going on there.
That's right. And it's very fast, very swift. Yes.
In Europe, a lot of it was from the guest workers from other countries, but they needed the chief laborer.
Oh yeah, they let the immigration. They let them. Yeah, they let them in.
But now we have a dilemma in this country because we're supposed to be based on the premise of freedom of religion in this country, as false as that was.
Right.
And so, are you really sure that we're turning a blind eye to it? I just spent some time in Brooklyn, not in the Orthodox part. I was in Brooklyn. Forget. But anyway, the first suburb of Brooklyn. But, yeah. So the thing, and there's a mosque there. There are a lot of people walking. They're all over. But
Brooklyn's a different planet.
Here's the thing about it, though. Are you really sure we're turning a blind eye and that we're not upset about this? Because what are we supposed to do? Say, we have separation of church and state. We have freedom of religion. But if you're Muslim, we don't want you.
Well, hold on a second. There's freedom of religion, but there's also incitement of speech. I mean, you can't walk around. It's against the law. First of all, you burn an American flag. You say that I want to destroy the country, that I want to adopt Sharia, that I want to uproot the entire... the question is, where does freedom of speech go to? I'm not so sure that it's so clear that by law that you're allowed to say, make public statements like that, that are inciting people towards murder. I'm not so sure that that's true.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not so clear that what they're doing is freedom of religion, freedom of speech, that it's acceptable.
And if they're doing it in their house of worship and not on the street?
I'm not so sure. If it's incitement towards murder or incitement towards terror, that certainly is not allowed. That's against the law.
We have to take Australia's outlook.
Out! I just wanted to make
don't like it, leave. Oh,
thank you very much. I'll be outside in the foyer.
This Shabbos, we have to have the Kala. A lot of Fel Kai is going to be in the community for Shabbat. So we'll have a Shabbat Kala should be in the shul, and we'll have a Shabbat Kala for at our home on Shabbat at 4:45 for the ladies. 4:45 on Shabbos for the ladies, we'll have a Shabbos Kala tea. Don't forget, please, to respond. Tuesday, we have the Tu B'Shvat Seder for the adults. That's at 7:45. That'll have a few of the pleasures and understanding Kabbalistically the concept of the world of eating. That'll be 7:45 here at the shul. On Wednesday at 4:45 will be for the kids, the Tu B'Shvat program for the kids here at the shul. That's on Wednesday. And Sarah Yocheved Rigler, we have next Shabbos, Happy Life, Sad Life. That'll be next week, Thursday as well. So please make sure the Tu B'Shvat Seders, both the kids and the adults, please respond with RSVP. Thank you for coming. The Kala tea is going to be here in the shul. At my house, The Kala tea is at my house.
They were wondering, how are you
going to
get
the...
No,
in my house.
It's at the rabbi's house.
We have two iPhones for sale.
Coming.
Well, this one I can't turn off. This one I turned off. Yeah, this is the last stage of development. Yeah, the souls. I think we're not giving away. No, not a lot of people. These both are yours.
Yeah.
No? One is your sister.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Oh, behind it,
Turkey.
Oh, so you already know bad places to be careful and all of that.
Yeah, let me just,
just give me a phone.
Oh, gosh. It won't let me enter my passcode to get out of this. I'm dying to talk to you.